vanished from the official record on a train trip to Moscow. The Soviets clamped the lid down on all further information. It would have tarnished Lenin's halo if it got out that he was dealing with the Germans over the fate of the Romanovs. What happened to the Romanov treasure? Only a small fraction of it was ever found. Your father reported his agent's findings to the king. He filed a report saying that the mother and girls were probably alive and asked for help in putting together a rescue scheme. King George washed his hands of the affair, although he and Nicholas were related. Remember that the hated Kaiser was cousin to George and Nicholas as well. Family loyalty only went so far among the royals. The king was afraid that he'd stir up the British left if he gave the women asylum. The Tsarina was German by birth, and Germany was the enemy. So, no attempt was made to rescue them. A rescue scheme was hatched by some Englishmen, but it didn't go anywhere because the family was moved. There were a couple of attempts by Cossacks, supported by Germans who wanted a restoration of Russia's imperial house. The Kaiser may have felt guilty about inflicting Lenin on the Tsar to take pressure off the Eastern Front. The most interesting plot was a scheme to kidnap the family and spirit them through German-occupied Ukraine, then across the Black Sea in a neutral ship. Why did it fail? It didn't, actually. They were rescued? Yes, but not by the Germans. The Cossacks didn't trust Germany. Somewhere along the way, possibly during that trek to Moscow, the intrepid band of Cossacks who had failed to save them once before managed to kidnap the family and fought their way to the Black Sea. Zavala picked up the manuscript. Major Yakovlev? Dodson smiled. The Cossack officer must have been extremely resourceful and determined. Yakovlev is vague about exactly how the women came under his protection. He was saving that for when he got out of Russia. The journal was to be published when the Romanovs made their appearance in Europe. This manuscript was to go to Europe by a neutral ship and would garner them the instant sympathy of the world. It came into the possession of my grandfather, and when the family failed to arrive, he kept it for want of anything better to do. Do you have any idea who might have sunk the ship? This is where it gets dicey, Dodson said with a frown. Especially in light of what you said about the ship having been sunk by gunfire. He took a deep breath. As my father recounts it in his papers, the family were to be taken secretly to Turkey, where a German U-boat would be waiting to spirit them out of the country. Turkey was allied with Germany. Britain was told of the plan and agreed not to attack the U-boat on its way to Europe. That was generous of the British. Dodson guffawed. Oh, they were a wily bunch in the good old days. Their generosity was based on the assumption that the family would be captured by the Bolsheviks. That was quite a gamble. Not really. England told Lenin and his thugs that the family were escaping in the Odessa Star. Your grandfather knew of this? He argued strenuously against it, but was overruled. By whom? By King George. Zavala's eyes narrowed. I see why you were reluctant to make this information public. Some people might not like learning that the king was a traitorous informant and accessory to a multiple murder. I don't know if I'd go so far as to identify the king as a criminal, though what he did was morally reprehensible. It was naivete on his part, but George never dreamed that Lenin would be so ruthless as to order them assassinated. My father said the king assumed the women would be kept in a convent. The Bolsheviks may have given the impression that no harm would come to them. They sat in silence for a few moments, alone with their thoughts, listening to the trill of the birds. Zavala shook his head in puzzlement. "There's something I don't get. A few years ago, the Russians dug up some bones that were supposedly identified as those of the Romanov family. The Soviet government was masterful at fabricating evidence. I would assume that they passed along that skill to their successors. There may be some truth to the story of the Tsar's bones, but even so, the remains of the boy, Alexis, and his sister, the Grand Duchess Maria, were never found." "Maria?" "Yes. She was the second youngest. Why?" Zavala went out to his car and returned with the Perlmutter file. He leafed through the contents and pulled out the book excerpt on the Little Mermaid, which he handed to Dodson. The Englishman donned a pair of wire-rimmed reading glasses. As he pored over the file, his expression grew grave. "Astounding! If this is accurate, the Romanov line didn't die out. Maria, or Marie, as she's called here, went on to marry and have children. That's my take on it. Do you know what this means? Somewhere there may be a legitimate heir to the Tsar's throne." He ran his fingers through his hair. "My God, what a catastrophe!" "I'm not sure I understand." Dodson composed himself. "Russia is in the midst of great turmoil. It is still seeking its identity. Beneath this bubbling cauldron is a fire of nationalism. Those who would go back to the days of Peter the Great and the Tsars have touched a yearning in the Russian people, but all they have had to sell is a memory of a forgotten time. With an actual heir to the Tsar, their cause would have focus. It is a country that still controls weapons of mass destruction and a major share of the world's natural resources. It will not be safe for the world if Russia lapses into a civil war and follows the lead of the worst kind of demagogue. British complicity in the plot against the Tsar will stir up all those paranoid feelings against the West." He affixed Zavala with a steely gaze. "Tell your superiors that they must be discreet. Otherwise, no one may be able to control the consequences." Zavala was bowled over by the emotional reaction from this reserved Englishman. "Yes, of course. I'll tell them what you said." But Dodson seemed to have forgotten that Zavala was even there. "The Tsar is dead," he murmured. "Long live the Tsar." Chapter 26, Washington, D.C. Leroy Jenkins caught his breath as he stepped from the wilting Washington heat into the cool interior of the 30-story green glass tower overlooking the Potomac. The exterior of the tall, tubular building was impressive enough, but nothing could have prepared him for his first glimpse inside NUMA headquarters. He craned his neck to gaze up to the top of the atrium lobby, then swept his eyes around the tumbling waterfalls and aquaria filled with exotic fish, taking in the huge globe of the world that rose from the center of the sea-green marble floor. Smiling like a child in a toy shop, he started across the giant lobby, threading his way among the gaggles of tourists who trailed behind impeccably uniformed guides. An attractive woman in her 20s, one of several receptionists at a long information desk, saw Jenkins approach and beamed him in with a pleasant smile. "May I help you?" Jenkins was struck dumb. On the flight from Portland, he'd rehearsed what he would say when he got to NUMA. Now his tongue seemed glued to the roof of his mouth. He was overcome by awe at being in the heart of the biggest ocean science agency in the world. He felt like Fred Flintstone visiting the Jetsons. As an oceanographer, he had long contemplated a trip to the holy grail of ocean science, but his teaching duties had intervened, and later he was consumed by his wife's illness. Now he'd reached the point where he didn't like to leave Maine because, as he joked, his gills would close up if he ventured too far from the sea. The air seemed to crackle with electrical energy. Every non-tourist in view clutched a laptop computer. No one carried anything remotely resembling the battered tan briefcase in his sweaty hand. Jenkins was uncomfortably aware of his wrinkled khaki pants, his worn hush puppies, and the faded blue chambray work shirt, damp from the heat. He removed the tan fisherman's cap and wiped the sweat off his forehead with a red bandana, immediately regretting the move because it made him look even more like a hick. He stuffed the bandana back into his pocket.
"Someone in particular you'd like to see?"
"Yes, but I'm not sure who it might be." Jenkins offered a weak grin. "Sorry to be so vague." The receptionist was familiar with the symptoms.
"You're not the first person who's been vague.
This place can be a bit overwhelming. Let's see what we can work out. Could you tell me your name?"
"Sure, it's Roy Jenkins. Dr. Leroy Jenkins, I mean. I taught oceanography at the University of Maine before I retired a few years ago."
"That narrows it down. Would you like to speak to someone in the oceanography division, Dr. Jenkins?" Hearing the title before his name gave him courage. He said,
"I'm not sure. I have some questions of a specialized nature."
"Why don't we start in oceanography and go from there?" The young woman picked up the phone, pressed a button, and spoke a few words.
"Go right up, Dr. Jenkins. The receptionist on the 9th floor is expecting you."
She flashed her fabulous smile again and directed her eyes to the next person in line. Jenkins made his way toward the ranks of elevators off to one side of the lobby. Still wondering if he had come all this way to make a fool of himself in front of some young PhD with a pocket protector and a condescending attitude, he stepped into an elevator and pushed a button. Too late now, he thought, as the elevator whisked him skyward. On the 10th floor of the Numa building, Hiram Yeager sat in front of a horseshoe-shaped console and stared at an immense computer monitor that looked as if it were suspended in space. Displayed on the screen was the image of a narrow-faced man with beetling brows bent over a chessboard. Yeager watched the man move the white rook 2 spaces. He studied the board a moment and said, "Bishop to Qe5. Check and checkmate." The man on the screen nodded and tipped his king over with a forefinger. In a thick accent, he said,
"Thank you for the game, Hiram. We must play again."
The screen went blank, except for a pale green afterglow. The middle-aged man sitting next to Yeager said,
"Very impressive. Viktor Karpov isn't exactly a slouch."
"I cheated, Hank. When I programmed all of Karpov's games into Max's databanks, I set up an array of responses based on Bobby Fischer's strategy. Fischer simply overrode any dumb move I made."
"It all sounds like magic to me," Hank Reed replied.
"Speaking of vanishing acts, I wonder where our pastrami sandwiches are." He licked his lips. "I think I'd work for Numa even if they didn't pay me, just so I could use the cafeteria." Yeager nodded in agreement. "Let's get back to work. If the delivery guy doesn't arrive in 5 minutes, I'll call again."
"Sounds good," Hank said.
"Did Austin ever say why he wanted this stuff?" Yeager chuckled knowingly. "Kurt's the ultimate poker player. He never shows his cards until he lays down his hand." Austin had called Yeager earlier in the day with a cheery, "Good morning." Getting right to the point, he'd said, "I need some help from Max. Is she in a good mood?"
"Max is always in a good mood, Kurt. As long as I ply her with electronic cocktails, she'll do anything I ask."
In a stage whisper, he said, "She thinks I want her for her mind and not her body."
"I didn't know Max had a body."
"She has her pick of bodies. Mae West, Betty Grable, Marilyn Monroe, Jennifer Lopez,
whatever I program in. Please soften her up with a few drinks and ask her to dig up what she can on the subject of methane hydrates. Austin had been thinking about methane hydrates since the Trouts had told him Ottoman Industries was attempting to mine them from the ocean floor. I'll have a package for you later today, if that's okay.
Fine. I'll be pretty much tied up with Admiral Sandecker this morning.
Yeager made no attempt to ask when Austin wanted the information. If Austin wanted it, it was important. And if it was important, he wanted it immediately. People who met Yeager for the first time sometimes found it difficult to reconcile the scruffy Levi's and T-shirt look with his reputation as a computer whiz. It only took a few minutes of watching him at work to see why Admiral Sandecker had made him the head of NUMA's Oceans Data Center. From his console, he had access to vast resources of data on ocean technology and history and every related bit of information on and under the seas. Finding his way through the massive amount of data at his command required a deft hand. Yeager knew that if Max searched out every mention of methane hydrates recorded, he would drown in the digital deluge. He needed someone to point the way. Hank Reed immediately came to mind. Reed was in his lab when Yeager called.
"Hi, Hank. I could use your geochemical expertise. Any chance you could break away from your Bunsen burners for a few minutes?"
"Don't tell me NUMA's resident computer whiz needs the help of a mere human being. What's wrong? Did your know-it-all machine blow a fuse?"
"Nope. Max truly does know it all, which is why I need someone on the slow side to bird-dog the data. Tell you what, I'll buy lunch."
"Flattery and food. An irresistible combination. I'll be right up." Reed walked into the data center wearing a warm smile. Despite their playful insults, they were the best of friends, bound by their eccentricities. With his graying ponytail and wire-rimmed granny glasses, Yeager looked like he belonged in the cast of Hair. Dr. Henry Reed had a round cherub's face and a high thatch of wheat-colored hair that added a few inches to his 5-foot height and looked like it could have been combed with a pitchfork. The thick, round glasses perched on his small nose gave him the expression of a benign owl. He took the chair Yeager offered and rubbed his pudgy hands together.
"Plunk your magic twanger, Froggy."
Yeager looked over the tops of his granny glasses.
"Huh?"
"It's from an old radio program I used to listen to when I was a kid. Froggy was a gremlin. Never mind. You probably never even heard of radio."
Yeager grinned.
"Sure I have. My grandmother told me about it. Television without pictures." He leaned back in his chair with his hands behind his head and said, "Max, say hello to my pal, Dr. Reed." A feminine voice purred through the speakers placed strategically around the room.
"Hello, Dr. Reed. How nice to see you again."
As the doors hissed shut behind him, Roy Jenkins thought it strange that he was the only one getting off the elevator. He looked at the numerals on the wall and swore to himself. He'd become the absent-minded professor he had always scorned. The receptionist had said the 9th floor. Preoccupied with his thoughts, he had pushed the button for the 10th. Instead of the standard office architecture of hallways, cubicles, and offices, a vast, glass-enclosed area took up the entire floor. Jenkins should have turned back to the elevator, but scientific curiosity got the best of him. He walked past banks of blinking computers, glancing from left to right, listening to the electronic whisperings. He could have landed on an alien planet peopled only by machines. With some relief, he came upon the two men behind the large glowing console at the center of the computer complex. They were looking at a large screen that seemed to hang by invisible wires and was dominated by the image of a woman in vivid color. She had topaz brown eyes, auburn hair, and the bottom of the monitor barely hid her ample cleavage.
The woman was talking, but even more odd, one of the men, who wore his long hair and a ponytail, was talking back to her. Thinking he had stumbled into a showing of a very private nature, Jenkins was about to back out, but the other man, who sported a hairdo like a wheat plant gone to seed, saw him and grinned. "At last, our pastrami sandwiches," he said.
"Pardon me?"
Reed saw that Jenkins was carrying a briefcase instead of a white paper bag, studied Jenkins's weathered and tanned face, and then took in the work shirt and cap.
"Guess you're not from the cafeteria," he said sadly. "My name's Leroy Jenkins. I'm sorry to bother you. I got off at the wrong floor and sort of wandered in here." He looked around. "What is this place?"
"Numa's Computer Center," said the ponytailed man. He had a boyish, clean-shaven face with a narrow nose and gray eyes. "Max can answer just about any question you throw her way."
"Max?"
Yeager gestured to the screen. "I'm Hiram Yeager. This is Hank Reed. That lovely lady up there is a holographic illusion. Her voice is a feminine version of my own. I used my own face originally, but I got tired of looking at myself and dreamed up a pretty woman. My own wife."
Max smiled. "Thank you for the compliment, Hiram."
"You're welcome. Max is smart as well as beautiful. Ask her any question you'd like. Max, this is Mr. Jenkins."
The image smiled and said, "Pleased to meet you, Mr. Jenkins."
"I've been in the wilds of Maine for too long," Jenkins thought. "Actually, it's Dr. Jenkins. I'm an oceanologist." He drew a breath in. "I'm afraid my questions are rather complicated. They've got to do with methane hydrates."
Yeager and Reed looked at each other, then at Jenkins.
Max said with a sigh that was more than human, "Is it really necessary to repeat myself?"
"Nothing personal, Dr. Jenkins. Max has been working on the same subject for the last hour or so," Yeager said.
He punched out the cafeteria number on the phone and turned to Jenkins. "We'd like you to join us for lunch."
Reed leaned forward. "I recommend the pastrami. It's an existential experience."
The sandwich was as tasty as promised. Jenkins realized that with the exception of the bag of peanuts he'd had on the plane, his stomach was empty. He took a swig of root beer to wash his lunch down and looked at the other men who were waiting expectantly.
"This is going to sound crazy," he said.
"Crazy is our middle name," Yeager said.
Reed nodded his head in agreement. Although the two men looked like an overaged hippie and a munchkin with a Don King hairdo, they appeared very bright. More important, they were interested in hearing his story.
"Don't say I didn't warn you," he said.
"Okay," he began. "I retired from teaching college a few years ago and bought a lobster boat in Rocky Point, my hometown."
"Uh-huh, a fisherman," Reed said.
"I knew it."
Jenkins smiled, then resumed.
"You probably read about the tsunami that hit there not too long ago."
"Yes, it was an awful tragedy," Reed said.
"It could have been worse." Jenkins explained his role in warning the town.
"Lucky you were there," Yeager said.
"Something puzzles me, though.
First time I've heard of something like that happening. New England isn't at the edge of a major fault like Japan or California."
"The only comparable precedent I found was the big wave caused by the Grand Banks earthquake in 1929. The quake's epicenter was under the ocean on the continental slope south of Newfoundland and east of Nova Scotia. The tremor was felt in Canada and New England, but the source was 250 miles from the nearest land, so damage was negligible. Roads were blocked by landslides, chimneys broken, and dishes rattled. Otherwise, the shock had little impact. The biggest effect was on the sea."
"In what way?"
Reed said. There were two ships near the epicenter. The vibrations were so violent they thought they'd lost a propeller or hit an uncharted wreck or sandbar. The quake created a great wave that struck the south coast of Newfoundland 3 hours later, running up into rivers and inlets in the little fishing villages along around 60 miles of coastline. The worst damage was at a wedge-shaped bay on the Berlin Peninsula. The tsunami rose to 30 feet at the apex of the bay, damaged docks and buildings, and killed more than 25 people.
Very similar to what happened at Rocky Point.
Almost mirror image. The fatality and injury rate was lower in my town, thank goodness. There was another important similarity. Both waves seem to have been caused by huge underwater slides. There was no doubt that an earthquake caused the Grand Banks disaster. The oceanic cables were broken in dozens of places. He paused. Here's where they were different. The Rocky Point slide seems to have been caused without a quake.
Interesting. Were there any seismic readings?
I checked with the Weston Observatory outside of Boston. The Grand Banks quake had a magnitude of 7.2, so we know something of that magnitude will cause a tsunami. The Rocky Point readings were more muddled. He paused. There was a shock, but it didn't fit the classic pattern for a quake.
Let me see if I'm clear on this. Are you really saying the Rocky Point slump was not from an earthquake?
I think that can be fairly well established. What I can't say is what actually caused the landslide. Jaeger looked over the tops of his granny glasses.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Something like that. I had read about the methane hydrate deposits found off the continental slope and wondered if instability in those pockets of gas could have caused the slump.
It's certainly possible, Reed said. There are huge pockets of the stuff off both coasts. We've found major deposits off of Oregon and New Jersey, for instance. You've heard of the Blake Ridge?
Sure. It's an undersea promontory a couple of hundred miles southeast of the U.S.
Off the North Carolina coast, to be exact. The ridge is loaded with methane hydrate. Some people think the ridge is a pressure cooker. Surveys have found craters pockmarking the ocean floor where the stuff is melted and seeped out, releasing methane gas.
Jenkins scratched his head.
I'm sorry to say I don't know a lot about hydrates. I try to keep up through the professional journals since leaving the university. But what with the lobstering and so on, I never seem to have enough time.
It's a comparatively new area. You're familiar with the chemical composition of hydrate?
It's made up of natural gas molecules trapped in ice.
That's right. Someone dubbed it fire ice. It was discovered in the 19th century, but our knowledge has been pretty sketchy. The first natural deposits were found under the permafrost in Siberia and North America. They called it marsh gas. Then in the 1970s, a couple of scientists from Columbia University found pockets under the seafloor when they were doing seismological studies at the Blake Ridge. In the 1980s, the Woods Hole submersible Alvin found stone undersea chimneys formed by escaping methane. I was on the first big survey back in the mid-1990s. That's when we discovered the deposits in the Blake Ridge. They're only a fraction of what's out there. The potential is vast.
Where are the major deposits?
Mostly along the lower slopes of the world's continental shelves, where the seabed drops from 400 feet or so into the abyss several miles deep. There are major pockets off both U.S. coasts. As I said, you can find it in Costa Rica, Japan, India, and under the Arctic permafrost. The sheer size of the deposits is astounding. The most recent estimates are 10,000 gigatons. That's double the total amount of all known reserves of coal, oil, and natural gas. Jenkins let out a low whistle. Waiting there to be tapped when we suck our petroleum reserves dry.
I wish it were so easy, Reed said with a sigh. The few technical problems have to be ironed out before extraction is practical.
Is it dangerous to drill?
The first time a ship drilled into a pocket was in 1970. Nothing happened, but drillers were afraid for years afterward that they'd get blown out of the water. Eventually, a few experimental bores showed that research drilling was safe. Getting hydrates to the surface to heat your home or run your SUV is another question. The environment is extremely hostile in the deep water where hydrates are found, and the stuff simply fizzes when we bring it up. The deposits may be another few hundred feet below the seafloor.
That sounds like a tough neighborhood for rigs to operate in.
Absolutely. A number of countries and companies are working on the problem, though. One method is pumping steam or water down the drill hole. This melts the hydrate and releases methane. Then you pump the methane to the surface of the seafloor through another drill hole. Next comes the question of what you do with it. When you remove the hydrate, the seafloor destabilizes.
There goes your expensive pipeline.
A good possibility. Which is why engineers have come up with a scheme to put a production facility on the seafloor. You pump the hydrate out and combine it with water. The mix goes into big tanks shaped like dirigibles. Submarines would tow them to the shallows, where the hydrates would be safely broken down into fuel and water. With any of those methods, it sounds like mining hydrates is going to be like walking on eggshells.
Even more difficult.
Now, back to your original question.
About hydrates as a source of earthquakes and big waves.
It's highly possible. There is evidence that the natural melting has destabilized seafloor slopes. They've found massive submarine landslides off the U.S. East Coast, Alaska, and other countries. The Russians found unstable hydrate fields off Norway. They think one of the biggest releases ever recorded caused the Storegga submarine landslide. 8,000 years ago, more than 1,000 cubic miles of sediments slid for miles down the slope of the Norwegian continental slope.
I'm acquainted with Storegga, Jenkins said.
Then you'd know that the huge mudslide caused unimaginable tsunamis. The Grand Banks and Rocky Point would have been bathtub waves by comparison.
Jenkins nodded.
What about man-made landslides? Possible?
I'd say they're plausible, sure.
A drilling platform could inadvertently cause a deposit to collapse, triggering a landslide.
Jenkins held his breath, then released it.
Inadvertently, yes. But could something like that be triggered deliberately?
The tone grabbed their attention.
Reed said, "What are you saying, Dr. Jenkins?"
Jenkins squirmed in his chair.
"It's been driving me crazy. My gut instinct has been in conflict with my scientific training, which says gather all the evidence before coming to a conclusion, especially one as wild as this."
Reed scratched his chin.
"Maybe, but as a scientist, I'm like you. I can't make that leap from conjecture to conclusion without a bridge of facts."
Yeager got into the discussion.
"Poetically said, Doc. Let's see if Max can help us. Were you eavesdropping, my love?"
The auburn-haired image of a woman reappeared. "It's hard not to listen in when I have 6 super-sensitive microphones. Where would you like me to take you?"
Yeager turned to the 2 scientists.
"Gentlemen, it's all yours."
Reed had been giving it some thought.
"Max, please give us an idea of the undersea methane hydrate deposits along the U.S. coasts."
The face vanished, and they were looking at a 3-dimensional rendering of the sea bottom to the east and west of the United States, complete with mountains and canyons. Pulsating patches of crimson appeared in the shimmering blue sea off the Atlantic and Pacific coasts.
"Now let's isolate this to the east coast." The shoreline between Maine and the Florida Keys appeared.
"Good.
Please zero in on Maine and show us the continental shelf. They were looking at the long, irregular coastline of the Pine Tree State, stretching from Canada to New Hampshire. A wavy line appeared off the coast, running through the red patches of hydrates. If I may, Jenkins interjected, could you highlight Rocky Point? A cornflower blue bullseye indicated Jenkins's hometown. A close-up aerial view of the town showing its bay and river appeared in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. Not bad, Jenkins said, noting the extra touch. Thank you, purred a disembodied voice. Jenkins gave Max his boat's position when he had first seen the nascent tsunami. A silhouette of a fishing boat appeared in the holographic sea. Now we need a diagram showing the major undersea faults. A spidery network of white lines appeared. The boat appeared to be in between Rocky Point and a major fault due east of the town. Yeager said, That was great, Max. While you're in profile mode, let's go back to the continental shelf at the epicenter of the shock. Displayed on the screen was a cross-section of the ocean floor, showing a wavy line representing the ocean's surface and a lower one that was the sea bottom. The continental shelf dropped off sharply. At the edge of the shelf was a thick fault that angled down. The fault intersected a variegated line that represented the methane hydrate deposit under the limestone crust. There's our trouble spot. Show us what happens when methane hydrates are released. A methane plume rose from the ocean floor. The sea bottom along the slope of the continental shelf collapsed. A depression occurred in the water surface where the landslide occurred. The surface of the water cratered above the slide. The water tried to stabilize, creating a bump that moved along the ocean surface. There's the genesis of the big wave, Reed said. Let me try something, Yeager said. You heard what Dr. Jenkins said about the Richter scale reading at that location. Please give us a simulation of what happened. Ripples that represented waves began to travel out from the area immediately around the slide. Max zoomed in on the wave heading for Rocky Point. When the moving arc was close to shore, the close-up of Rocky Point enlarged to fill the whole screen. The wave could be seen rolling into the harbor, onto the shore, and up the river. Without being asked, Max split the screen, showing the side view displaying the profile of the wave. The tsunami grew as it approached land, morphed into a giant watery claw, and crashed down on the sleepy harbor. There was silence in the room as Max repeated the scene again and again in fast and slow motion. Yeager swiveled in his chair and said, Comments, gentlemen? We've established effect, Jenkins said. The big question is whether the cause was man-made. It's happened before, Reed said. Remember what I said about the drill platforms collapsing after accidentally releasing a plume? Max, I know you've worked hard, but I wonder if you could do me a favor.
Of course, Dr. Jenkins.
Thank you. Go back to your map of the East Coast and show us weak spots, similar to those off Maine. The map appeared again with pulsating bullseyes of varying sizes. The biggest were off the New England coast, New Jersey, Washington, Charleston, and Miami. Max, please simulate what would happen if the continental shelf collapsed at the major intersections with methane hydrate deposits. Within an instant, waves rippled out from the larger epicenters, reaching a height of 30 feet, hitting the coast and flowing into bays and up rivers and far onto land. Reed's eyes blinked rapidly behind the thick lenses. Goodbye, Boston, New York, Washington, Charleston, and Miami. Meth is death, Yeager said softly. Seeing the puzzled faces of the older man, he explained, It's an old hippie saying, meant to warn people of the dangers of using methamphetamines to get high. Reed said, This is worse than any drug, my friend. Jenkins cleared his throat. There was something I didn't mention.
He told them about the encounter with the huge ship the same day as the Rocky Point tsunami.
It sounds as if you think the ship had something to do with the landslide and the tsunami, Yeager said.
Jenkins nodded.
Were there any markings on it?
Yes, as a matter of fact. The ship was registered in Liberia, as a lot of them are, and the name on the hull was Ottoman Explorer One. I checked the dictionary. It means the head man of a bunch of Cossacks.
Ottoman? Are you sure?
Yes, does the name ring a bell?
Possibly.
How long are you in Washington, Dr. Jenkins? Yeager asked.
I don't know. As long as I have to be, I guess. Why?
Yeager rose from his chair.
I've got a couple of people I want you to meet.
Chapter 27. The sunlight streaming through the tinted floor-to-ceiling window washed the sharp features of Admiral James Sandecker in a sea-green patina that made his face look like a bronze bust of Father Neptune. From his office on the top floor of NUMA headquarters, he had an unparalleled view of official Washington. He stood at the window in thought, his authoritative blue eyes sweeping the city, taking in the White House, the tall spire of the Washington Monument, and the dome of the Capitol, as if he were a hawk searching for its prey. Austin had spent most of the morning filling Sandecker in on the events in the Black Sea. The Admiral had been fascinated by the description of the subpen and intrigued at the meeting with Petrov and the Odessa Star link to Lord Dodson, whom he had met. Occasionally he asked a question to clarify or offer a theory of his own, but he listened in stony silence, tugging at his precisely trimmed red Van Dyke beard, when Austin told him about the massacre aboard the Sea Hunter. At the end of the grisly narrative, he rose from his desk without a word and walked over to gaze out the window. After a few moments, he turned to Austin and Gunn, who sat in leather chairs in front of the desk, and said, "In all my days as a Navy commander, I never lost a ship or its crew. Damned if I'm about to start now. This son of a bitch and his friend Ratzov are not going to get away with the massacre of an entire NUMA crew." The temperature in the room seemed to drop 20 degrees. Sandecker came over and settled behind his desk.
"How is Ms. Montague, the young lady who survived the attack?"
"She's tough," Austin said. "She insisted on staying aboard the ship while the replacement crew brings the Sea Hunter back to port."
"Make sure I see the young lady on her return."
"I'll do that," Austin said. "What's the latest from the CIA? Sandecker reached into the humidor on his desk, pulled out a cigar, and lit it.
"The CIA is barking up the wrong tree. The FBI is skeptical, and the armed forces aren't much good unless you point them in the right direction and give them marching orders. The Secretary of State doesn't return my phone calls."
"What about the White House?"
"The President is sympathetic and concerned, of course, but I can't help thinking there is a bit of glee among some of his cabinet, a hint that the massacre was justified retribution for sticking our nose in where it doesn't belong. They are angry that NUMA rescued the NR-1 crew."
"What difference does it make who rescued the crew as long as it was rescued?" Austin said in frustration. Sandecker puffed out a plume of smoke that temporarily enveloped his head in a purple cloud.
"I assume that was a rhetorical question, because you're much too savvy in the ways of this city. You know that gratitude simply does not exist inside the Beltway. We've stolen their thunder, and they resent that."
Gunn sighed. "That's pretty much the scuttlebutt I've heard. There's even criticism behind our back that our bungling is the reason that the captain and pilot are still missing with the sub."
"Nice of us to provide an excuse for the incompetence of other agencies," Sandecker said. "But I'm afraid it means NUMA is on its own when it comes to the Sea Hunter business. Any lead on this man, Boris?"
"He's a will-o'-the-wisp," Austin said. "Our best chance is to concentrate on Ratzov.
At last report, his yacht had left the Black Sea, and we're trying to track it down.
We're going to have to do better, Sandecker said.
Sandecker's intercom beeped softly, and the voice of his secretary came on.
I know you're in conference, Admiral, but Mr. Jaeger is here with two other gentlemen, and he says it's urgent that they see you.
Send them in, please, Sandecker said. A moment later, the office door opened and Jaeger came in, followed by the diminutive Dr. Reed and a stranger. Sandecker had spent too much time on the water not to recognize Jenkins as a fisherman, especially after they shook hands and he felt the barnacle-hard calluses. He greeted them warmly and told the men to pull up chairs.
Well, Hiram, what brings you out of your sanctum sanctorum?
I think Dr. Jenkins can explain it better than I can.
Jenkins was nervous at being in the presence of the legendary director of NUMA. But once he started to talk, he hit a stride.
When Jenkins finished his saga, Reed gave his opinion as a geochemist. Finally, Jaeger pitched in, passing around printouts of the diagrams Max had projected onto the screen. Sandecker sat back in his chair, tenting his fingers, his eyes alert to every nuance. When they were through with their presentation, he tapped his intercom.
Please see if Dr. Wilkins can come up from the geology department.
Dr. Elwood Wilkins arrived a few minutes later. He was a slim, reserved Midwesterner who looked like one of those movie character actors who always played the kindly pharmacist or family doctor. Sandecker pulled over another chair close to his desk. He passed Wilkins the printouts and gave the geologist a few minutes to study them. Wilkins finished reading the material and looked up. Sandecker answered the question in the scientist's eyes.
These gentlemen have suggested that it is possible for the edge of the continental shelf along the east coast to cave in, creating destructive tsunamis.
While I value their opinion, it never hurts to hear from a disinterested observer. What do you think?
Wilkins smiled.
Oh, I don't think there's any danger of the Atlantic City boardwalk being washed into the sea.
Sandecker raised an eyebrow.
But, Wilkins added, there is new research which indicates that what they suggest is not at all far-fetched. The rock under the overlying layer of the continental shelf is quite waterlogged. If the pressure exerted by the sea bottom reached a critical state, the water would squeeze out. It's as if you stepped on a balloon. The blowout could cause landslides that deform the water and send giant waves toward the shore. Some of my colleagues at Penn State University have run computer models demonstrating that the possibility is very real.
These slides would have to be triggered by a quake, Sandecker said.
A quake could do it, most certainly.
Could it happen on the East Coast? Gunn asked.
Wilkins tapped the sheaf of printouts in his hand.
This material pretty much spells it out. The continental shelf runs the full length of the coast. In several places along its slope are big cracks and craters where the potential for landslides is greater.
Could a slide be caused by something other than a quake? Gunn said.
It could happen spontaneously.
I'm sorry, I can't be more specific. This is a whole new area of science.
I was thinking of a release of methane hydrate.
Why not? If the hydrate layer is destabilized, sure, the whole shooting match could come tumbling down and set off your giant waves.
Sandecker could see Wilkins' lips about to form a question. He cut the discussion short.
Thank you, Doctor. You've been a great help, as always.
He ushered Wilkins to the door, patted him on the back, and thanked him again. Returning to the others, he said,
I hope you weren't insulted at my bringing Dr. Wilkins in. I wanted to hear from an independent source.
From what we heard, Gunn said, I'd say there's a pretty good case here that Rotsoff has discovered how to cause a tsunami. The wave that struck the main coast was a dry run, if you'll excuse the expression. If we're correct in our assumption, he's somehow capable of causing enormous destruction.
The Ottoman explorer is the key, Austin said.
We've got to find her.
We'll have to do more, Sandecker said with quiet urgency. We've got to get aboard that ship.
Chapter 28, Rocky Point, Maine. Before the big wave had hit, Rocky Point had been the quintessential rock-ribbed Maine town, its picturesque harbor and neat clapboard and shingle houses appearing in countless calendars. The tidy Main Street could have come from a Frank Capra movie. But as Jenkins's boat moved out of the harbor, Austin gazed back toward land and thought that the town now looked like one of those pictures where the viewer was challenged to detect the mistakes. Plenty was wrong with this picture. The waterfront lobster restaurants, the fish pier, and the controversial motel were gone, and all that was left were pilings that jutted from the water like bad teeth. Spherical day-glow warning buoys bobbed on the water to mark sunken wrecks. Cranes clawed away at the wreckage of boats on shore. Debris of every kind swirled in the kestrel's wake. Had Austin been of a more poetical bent, he would have said that the big wave had stolen the town's soul. What a mess was the best he could come up with.
Could have been worse, said Police Chief Charlie Howes, who stood next to Austin in the boat's stern.
Yeah, if hit by a nuclear missile, Austin said with a shake of his head.
Yep, Howes replied, not letting an outlander outdo his main talent for brevity of speech.
Austin had been introduced to the chief a few hours earlier. A NUMA executive corporate jet had whisked Austin, Trout, and Jenkins to Portland Airport. Jenkins had called ahead to Chief Howes, and he was waiting at the airport in a police cruiser to drive the men to Rocky Point. After the meeting with Sandecker, Austin had gone to his office with the satellite photos of the Ottoman Explorer and studied them under a high-powered magnifying glass. Even though the pictures had been shot from thousands of feet up, they were sharp and detailed. He could easily read the ship's name on the hull and see people on deck. Austin was immediately struck by the ship's resemblance to the Glomar Explorer, the 600-foot-long salvage vessel Howard Hughes had built in the 1970s on secret contract to the CIA to retrieve a sunken Soviet submarine. Tall derricks and cranes, similar to those on the Glomar, extended off the deck like waterborne oil rigs. Austin examined the ship from stem to stern, paying particular attention to the deck area around the derricks. He made a few sketches on a pad of paper and sat back in his chair, a smug smile on his face. He had figured out a way to get into the ship. It was a long shot and depended on how close he could get to the Ottoman Explorer. The vessel would run for cover at the first sight of a NUMA ship. He thought about the problem for a few minutes, recalling his Black Sea experience with Captain Kamal, then picked up his phone, called Jaeger, and asked where Jenkins was.
Doc Reed is giving him the NUMA VIP tour. He's offered to put Jenkins up for the night before he catches a plane back to Maine tomorrow.
See if you can track them down and give me a call. Austin's phone rang a few minutes later. Austin outlined his plan to Jenkins, making no effort to soft-pedal its possible dangers. Jenkins didn't hesitate for a second. When Austin was through describing his wild scheme, Jenkins said,
"I'll do anything you can think of to get back at the bums who ruined my town."
Austin told Jenkins to enjoy his tour while he made a few phone calls. The first call was to the NUMA transportation section to see if fast transportation was available. The second was to the Trout's Georgetown townhouse. Gamay had left a message saying she and Paul were home from Istanbul and were standing by for orders. Austin got Paul on the phone and brought him up to date. In the meantime, Jenkins started calling those local fishermen whose boats were still afloat and asked if they would like to do a job. At Austin's suggestion, Jenkins told the fishermen that NUMA needed their boats for a deep ocean species study. As a bonus, the substantial sum they were being paid would be matched by no-strings grants to get their port back into shape without going through the usual government red tape.
Jenkins had no trouble recruiting fishermen, and when the Kestrel left port shortly after dawn, six other lobster boats and trawlers trailed behind him single file. Charlie Howes had insisted on going along, and Jenkins was glad to have him. The chief had trapped lobsters for a living before joining the police department and hadn't lost his sea sense. The fishing fleet passed the rock-ribbed promontory that gave the town its name and entered the open ocean. The sea was a bright bottle green. Only a few whispery cirrus clouds marred the azure sky, and the breeze was a gentle westerly. The line of boats plodded east, then south, climbing the rolling swells and sliding down the other sides in an easy rhythm. Periodically, Gamay called from Numa headquarters with the Ottoman explorer's position as seen by satellite. Austin penciled the positions on a chart of the Gulf of Maine, the expansive stretch of water between the long Maine coast and the curving arm of Cape Cod. The ship seemed to be moving in a big, lazy circle. Austin guessed it was in a holding pattern. Gamay used a simple code so anyone listening would think they were hearing fishermen's chatter. Jenkins and Howes politely ignored Gamay's butchering of the Maine dialect, but when the voice that came over the speaker said, "Catching some good haddock and flounder south-east of my last set, eh, yup?" they could remain silent no longer. "Yup?" Jenkins cringed. "Did she say, yup?" Howes shook his head. "I've lived down east my whole life, and I've never heard anyone say, yup. Wouldn't know what it means." Trout suppressed a smile. Mumbling an apology, he explained that Gamay had seen too many episodes of Murder, She Wrote, which had been set in a Hollywood version of a Maine town. Jenkins cut him off. With clear excitement in his voice, he pointed to a large blip on the radar screen. "There she is, no doubt about it." Austin, who was leaning over his shoulder, looked at the target to the southeast. "Yep," he said. Jenkins gunned the throttle, picking up speed. The other boats did the same. It was more than a matter of impatience. Jenkins wasn't lulled by the playfulness of the sea. He had been studying the fetch, the distance between waves, with an experienced eye, assessing the situation as a fisherman and a scientist. "We've got some weather coming in," he said. Austin said, "I've been listening to the NOAA report on the radio. I don't need the squawking of a computer-generated voice to tell me there's a storm on the way," Jenkins said with a grin. "You just have to know how to read the signs." Since leaving port, Jenkins had watched the clouds gather and thicken and the sea spectrum shift to an oily gray. The breeze had moved a couple of compass points to the east. "If we get our work here done quickly, we can get back to port ahead of the storm. Problem is that if the sea and the wind kick up, it could be dangerous hauling back on our net." "I understand," Austin said. "Paul and I will get ready." "Might be a good idea," Chief Howes said, his easygoing voice gaining an uncharacteristic tautness. "We've got company." The chief was pointing at a huge, dark shape that loomed from the gathering fog. As the amorphous mass grew closer, it lost its spectral aspect, and the lines that had been softened by the vaporous mists hardened into the silhouette of a very large ship. The vessel was completely black, from the waterline to the top of the single funnel protruding from the high superstructure. Derricks and cranes bristled from the deck like the quills on a porcupine. The dull, light-absorbing paint made the ship hard to see and gave it an evil, brooding aspect that wasn't lost on the other fishermen. The radio crackled with excited voices. One fisherman said, "Geez, Roy, what's that thing? Looks like a floating hearse." "Hearse," said another voice. "Looks like the whole damned funeral parlor." Austin smiled at the chatter. Anyone listening to the comments would know they hadn't been rehearsed. Jenkins warned his fellow fishermen to keep a sharp eye out so they wouldn't be run down. They didn't have to be told and gave the monster ship a wide berth. Austin estimated the ship's speed at around 10 knots. The Ottoman explorer seemed to slow as it came nearer. A dot
detached itself from the deck. The speck grew larger, buzzing like a hornet stirred from its nest. Moments later, the black helicopter flew low over the fishing fleet. Jenkins and Howes gave the aircraft a friendly wave. The chopper circled the fishing fleet a few times, then headed back to the ship. From inside the pilot house, where he and Trout were donning their scuba gear, Austin watched the departing aircraft with calm eyes.
"Guess we passed inspection," Austin said. "That was a lot friendlier than the reception Gamay and I got when we poked around Ottoman's property in Novorossiysk. You can thank Jenkins for that. It was his idea to have lots of witnesses so Ottoman would stay on the straight and narrow." Austin was glad that he had listened to Jenkins when he'd asked if he'd be willing to offer his services. Jenkins pointed out that there was safety in numbers. Since the vessel was sitting in prime fishing grounds, it was not all that suspicious for boats to be trawling in the area. In fact, Austin could see a half dozen fishing boats tending their nets on the way out. Austin had based his plan on the successful infiltration of the subbase from Captain Kamal's fishing boat. Penetrating the sub pens had been easy compared with what he had in mind now. Unlike the scruffy Cossacks, who were more interested in playing people polo than standing guard, watchful and well-armed sentries would be manning the Ottoman vessel. Then Austin caught the break he was looking for. The ship plowed to a stop and floated dead in the water. Jenkins ran his boat as a trawler when he wasn't going after lobsters, and it was fitted out with a drum-like stern hauler to handle the net. With the help of the chief, he got the net in the water. Then the Kestrel got underway again and made a sweep by one side of the ship 100 yards off. The maneuver gave those on the ship a chance to inspect the fishing boat at close range. What they didn't see were the two divers hanging off the opposite side of the boat. After traveling about halfway along the length of the ship, Jenkins cut the Kestrel's engine to an idle and went out onto the deck. He and Howes tinkered with the hauler as if there was a problem. During the pause, Austin and Trout dropped into the water and dove under the boat. They wanted to get deep and out of the way of the net. It was agreed that Jenkins would make a sweep by one side of the ship, then trawl for a couple of miles before turning back and returning on the other side. That gave them an hour to get on board the ship and back. They would keep in touch with Jenkins using their underwater communicators to talk to a hydrophone Trout had hung into the water before they went over the side. They swam deeper, moving their legs in a steady flutter that ate up the distance. They could hear the muffled grumble of the fishing boat engine as Jenkins got underway again and dove to 35 feet, where the visibility was still fair. With powerful scissors kicks, they covered the distance to the ship in a short time. The gigantic hull emerged from the murk like the body of an enormous whale asleep on the surface. Austin signaled Trout to go deeper. When they were directly under the massive keel, they looked up and snapped their lights on. It was hard not to be unnerved by thousands of tons of black steel floating above their heads. "Now I know how a bug feels just before someone steps on it," Trout said, gazing up at the massive hulk. "I was thinking the same thing, but I didn't want to make you nervous." "Too late. Where do you want to start?" "If I interpreted the satellite photos correctly, we should find what we're looking at midships." They swam slowly upward until the ship's barnacle-encrusted bottom entirely filled the lenses of their face masks. In the beam of his light, Austin saw what he was looking for. A rubber-edged seam that ran across from one side of the flat-bottomed hull to the other. "Bingo," he said. When Austin had first looked at the satellite pictures, he'd noticed an open area around one of the derricks that rose from the deck. Someone had carelessly left off a tarp that covered the opening, and he could see down into a black void. He was sure he was looking into a moon pool, a docking space similar to that on the Argo and other Numa ships. Austin knew from experience that odds favored the pool's gates being closed. It was standard operating procedure. Otherwise, the drag from the open sea would slow the ship down.
But he remembered that some Numa ships had a smaller pool used for launching ROVs. He saw what he was looking for on the port side, forward of the larger moon pool, an indented rectangle about 12 feet square. When they swam close, they saw that the gates of the ROV launch well were shut tight. Austin unclipped the oxy-arc cutting torch from his belt and uncoiled the hose. Trout produced the oxygen tank he had been carrying and coupled it to the hose. From his belt bag, Austin pulled out two small, powerful magnets with hand grips on them. He attached the magnets to the hull, then he and Trout slipped plastic shades over their masks to shield their eyes from the bright flame. While Austin held onto the magnet with one hand, Trout lit the torch. Even with the protection of the eye shades, it was like looking at the sun. Austin began to cut, hoping that the pool cover was thinner than the actual hull. Although the ship wasn't moving, water churned around its great bulk and created eddies of current that pulled at Austin's body. With Trout's help, he had been able to stay more or less in one place, but a particularly violent current twisted him completely around. He had to let go of the magnet, and when he made a grab with the other hand in reflex, he dropped the torch. Trout was having similar problems, only he lost the oxygen tank. They managed to grab onto the magnets and whipped their eye shades off in time to see the tank and the torch, still lit, plunge out of sight into the depths. Every sailor's curse Austin had learned in years at sea crackled in Trout's earphones. After exhausting his repertoire of curses, he said, "I couldn't hold on to the torch. You may have noticed that I lost the tank. I didn't realize you knew so many cuss words." Austin managed to chuckle. "Zavala taught me the ones in Spanish. Sorry for dragging you all this way for nothing. If I weren't under a giant ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Gamay would have me wallpapering our townhouse. Got any backup plans? Maybe if we knock, they'll open the doors. Or we swim to the surface, look for a ladder hanging down, and climb aboard." "Hardly practical." "You asked if I had backup ideas. You didn't say they had to be practical." Austin was about to give the word to head back when Trout let out a yell of surprise and jabbed his forefinger straight down. Paul's sharp fisherman's eye had seen faint lights rising from the darkness below. The hazy glow reminded Austin of the luminescent fish William Beebe had found on his half-mile dive in a bathysphere. The oncoming object grew larger. They hurried out of its path until they were off to one side of the ship. They turned around and saw a small submarine ascend until it was about 100 feet beneath the hull of the Ottoman ship. The sub was clearly outlined by its running lights. "I'll be darned," Trout said, recognizing the distinctive silhouette. "It's the NR-1. What's she doing here? More important, where's she going next?" Austin's nimble mind had already sprinted several steps ahead. "Let's go for a boat ride." Austin angled his body downward and swam behind the hovering sub. He had once made a dive on the NR-1 and knew a camera was mounted forward of the conning tower. He and Trout grabbed onto the stair rungs built into the sail and hung on. Within seconds, a thin, glowing line of yellow light appeared above. The moon pool gates were being retracted. Trout looked up, the illumination from above reflected in his mask lens. "I think I saw this on the X-Files when the aliens abducted a human." "It's always nice to meet new friends," Austin said, his eyes glued to the line as it widened into a long, narrow rectangle, then a square of blazing light. The sub's vertical thrusters whirred, and the NR-1 rose slowly into the ship. Austin and Trout slid off the deck before the sub surfaced inside the pool. They swam toward a dark area between the circles of illumination cast by the lights inside the ship. At the edge of the pool, they cautiously poked their heads from the water. From the safety of the shadows, Austin took measure. The pool was about 200 feet long and half as wide. Steel mesh catwalks, accessed by short flights of open stairs, ran along both sides. Men in coveralls leaned over the railings and watched the NR-1 emerge from the water. Then the loud grinding of gears filled the enormous chamber as the pool doors closed. Heavy-duty hoists, fitted with steel hooks, descended from the ceiling. A door opened in the side of the chamber, and several divers dressed in dry suits jumped into the water. They slid wide yokes under the front and back of the sub. The yokes were attached to the hooks, and powerful winches lifted the sub like the chain falls that were used to yank car engines out. The hydraulic gates slid shut, sealing the chamber from the sea, and with a mighty grumble, invisible pumps began to suck water from the pool. The powerful pumps cleared the pool in minutes. Then the winches lowered the sub. Crews of men flowed down the stairs onto the slimy floor of the pool. While some men swept the deck clear of seaweed and flopping fish, others attached cables to the NR-1 and braced it with timber so it wouldn't shift with the ship's movement. The whoosh of ventilators brought fresh air into the space. Austin and Trout had scrambled up a ladder when the pumping started, and now they hung above the deck. The weight of their scuba equipment pulled at their arms and fingers. While they huddled in the shadows, below them, in the glare of lights, men leaned a ladder against the sub. The hatch opened in the conning tower, and a man with a white beard climbed out. He had a revolver holster on his belt and matched the description Ensign Kreisman had given of Pulaski, the phony scientist who'd pulled a gun on the NR-1. Two more men came out. Austin recognized Captain Logan and the pilot of the NR-1 from pictures he'd been shown. Four more men emerged. They had tough, impassive faces and carried heavy-duty firearms that identified them as guards. The NR-1 men were ushered up the stairs and disappeared from view. Hauling bags of sea debris, the last of the cleaning crew followed. The lights went out, except for a glow above their heads.
"What now?" Trout said. "We've got two choices. Up or down?"
Trout looked at the darkness below them and then grabbed the rung above his head and started to climb. The scuba gear seemed to get heavier the higher they got. Luckily, they had to climb less than 20 feet before they reached a narrow landing. With a mighty grunt, Trout pulled himself up and over the rail and slipped off his tanks and weight belt. He gave Austin a hand, and they both sat there, catching their breath. While he sat with his back to the bulkhead, Austin retrieved his Bowen from a watertight pack. Trout carried a Sig Sauer 9mm pistol of Swiss design. They walked to where the short landing joined a catwalk at a right angle. The catwalk ran into a well-lit passageway. Seeing that it was deserted, they kept on the move. They came upon a large alcove that sheltered a shiny, white, domed structure with small portholes on its side. They recognized the white dome immediately as a decompression chamber. After making sure no one was using the chamber, they went back for their scuba gear and stashed it inside. Then they slipped out of their dry suits and stowed them with the tanks. A short distance from the decompression chamber,